Welcome to Betrayal Recovery Radio, the official podcast of APSATS, the Association of Partners of Sex Addict Trauma Specialists, hosted by Dr. Jake Porter. APSATS is a nonprofit organization providing professional training and compassionate support to partners affected by problematic sexual behavior and betrayal trauma. In each episode, Dr. Jake guides a conversation of enlightening insights and practical tools to empower those affected by sex addiction and betrayal trauma to use their voices and live their values. The mission of Betrayal Recovery Radio is to offer hope to those in need of healing and growth to those moving through grief. And now, here's your host, Dr. Jake Porter.
Welcome to another episode of Betrayal Recovery Radio. I am Dr. Jake Porter, and I'm excited about this episode we have to offer you. You know, when you've discovered hidden betrayal in your relationship, as I've seen happen with so many couples that I've worked with, women, men that I've worked with, there are many, many questions. And these questions can go lots of different directions. They are intricate. They are complex. They do not lend themselves to easy, simple, straightforward answers. And if you start to try to Google these questions, if you start to try to just hunt on your own within your own, you know, powers, it can be confusing. It can be discouraging. You can find things that are contradicting, and that leads to increased stress, increased anxiety, and often leads to a lot of hopelessness and despair as well. That is why it's so important to have trained professionals who are helping you on this journey, who are able to help connect you with healthy support networks of others who are on this journey, others who've experienced this, who are a little further along than maybe you are, so that you can hear real life experience, not just from professionals, but also from those who have lived it. And today, what we're going to offer you on this episode is a conversation looking at some of the hard questions. I will be joined by several colleagues today, Wendy Conquest, Dan Drake, Jeannie Vatuni, and Tim Stein, who together are not just colleagues, but also great friends who host the podcast Conversations on Sex, Addiction, and Relationships. These four really have a great chemistry together. I think you'll hear that in the conversation as you get to listen in on it. But they are also a fount of wisdom together. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to take on some hard questions, some real questions that we often hear from those who have discovered hidden betrayal within their relationships. And you're going to get to go along and hear differences of opinion, hear a very civil conversation, hear dialogue, which I think is so important, so necessary, and so healthy, certainly within this field, but I think also our society at large could use a good dose of that. So yes, if you can't tell, I'm super excited about this episode, about having these guests on and offering this to you all. Now, before we get into that conversation with the hosts of Conversations on Sex, Addiction, and Relationship podcast, I want to let you know of a few things coming up for APSATS. APSATS is the sponsor of this podcast. This is the official podcast of the Association of Partners of Sex Addict Trauma Specialists. And so here are a few things that APSATS has coming up that may be of interest to you. Later this month, October 20th through the 22nd, Dan Drake and Janice Cottle will be once again teaching their Restoring Truth Disclosure Guide training. Then two big things coming up in November. November 1st through the 3rd is the APSATS 2023 conference. The theme is Trauma-Informed Care for Partner Betrayal. Lots of great speakers, and they even asked me to be a part of it. So I'll be a speaker during that event as well. It is all online, so no matter where you are, you can tune in and benefit from this amazing conference that will be going on. And then later on in the month of November, November 14th through 17th, APSATS will have its sort of foundational cornerstone training, the Multidimensional Partner Trauma Model Training. This will be live via Zoom. And if you are a helping professional, you are a coach, or you are a therapist, a counselor who works with or desires to work with those who have experienced betrayal trauma, I cannot emphasize to you enough how helpful you will find this training. If those dates don't work for you, know that there will be another offering coming up in January. Those dates are January 22nd through 25th, 2024. So you could go ahead and mark those off. You can actually find more details about all of these events at appsats.org. And that is also where you would go to register for any of these events. Okay. Thank you again for joining me. I know you're going to get a lot out of this conversation. Join me now as we think about some of the hard questions. Well, welcome to Betrayal Recovery Radio. Welcome to all the members of Conversations, Dan, Tim, Jeannie, and Wendy. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Yes. I'm excited about this. This is months and months of planning and in scheduling in the works, trying to get this meeting. I think this is the most guests on the podcast, at least since I've been hosting it. So that's pretty cool. I'm excited about this because we get to expose our audience to all of you and what you do and your incredible dynamic together. So y'all have a podcast that you do together called Conversations. Would one of you talk about that? Just kind of talk about how that came about and what you do on this podcast.
So this podcast was originally developed during COVID. And I can say that I was experiencing a lot of loneliness and isolation and not being able to talk with colleagues because everything was virtual. And so the conversations and discussions that I would have with other psychotherapists had pretty much stopped. And so Dan and I had scheduled a time to talk, and it was so wonderful to be able to talk to another colleague and talk to somebody in the field that I specialize in. And Dan and I had written a book together, so that there was that collaboration there. And so,
what book is it that you and Dan wrote together?
Yes, so we wrote Letters from a Sex Addict. Thank you, Tim. And so, you know, I really was sharply aware of the deficit. And during that conversation, I said, Dan, you know, I think it would be great if we did a podcast and had conversations and had discussions on topics that we're curious about or that we have strong opinions about or that we're struggling about. And Tim and Jeannie are in Santa Rosa, California. It's going to be virtual. It's over a virtual platform. So we could do this. You know, why don't we talk to Tim and Jeannie and see if they're up for it? And so that was, in my recollection, how this all started.
No, I think that's accurate. We're all together doing this because of Wendy. So if you like,
that was the spark, but that was just the beginning.
That is true, though. Wendy and any of you
who are like unhappy with the podcast we have out there, just be aware that it's Wendy's fault.
One of the pieces is that it's I think of therapists as kind of cagey cats sometimes. And so we're difficult sometimes. I'll speak for myself. There's not everybody that I like to collaborate with or that I get along with. And so to have three other professionals that I can talk with, feel supported by, be heard by, and really have mutual respect, and that's rare. I believe that that's very rare in our field.
Well, and in all honesty, I mean, granted, you know, Wendy did spearhead this, and I'm actually very grateful that she did that. But started, and it resonated with Jeannie and I also, which is, you know, there should always be jets.
I'm sorry. Are you guys hearing this? I'm not in my usual office. There are fighter jets flying overhead, and so we'll see how that's going. Sorry, guys.
I think this is perfect. Yes.
Tune it out.
Tim, I want to let you. I want to let you finish that thought, but here's, I just have to interject here for anyone who is listening and not watching the video of this podcast. I want to encourage you, you need to go and watch the video because you can literally see on the faces of everyone. You can see the fun and the affection and that respect. And that is, you know, I think that is something really unique that you guys are bringing, because when you listen to a podcast and it's a guest and they don't really know you very well and all, it's okay and it can be helpful, but you guys really do offer something unique in that way.
Well, yeah. And that's the thing, you know, like Dan was saying, you know, one, we need to have at least one episode with a fighter jet. So, you know, check that one off. And two, he was saying it needs to be fun. And, you know, we are all professionals. We love having these professional conversations. We all are very passionate about doing this work. But what really keeps us going is that the four of us just have a ball together. We have so much fun, you know, and we're in agreement, and then we give each other a hard time, and, you know, but it's always fun. It's very respectful, but it's always fun. And I'm just grateful that I get to be involved with this kooky bunch of people.
Yeah. Speak for yourself now.
Yeah, I'm curious. Well, I'm curious, you know, as y'all have been doing this. Go ahead, Jeannie. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I want to add, and I think there's a lag going on a little bit, so I apologize if I'm accidentally speaking over folks.
Okay.
That it's got to be fun for us. And the other part was, how can it be different than a lot of other podcasts out there? And how can we bring quality information or discussions about hard questions and hear it from all different perspectives? Because I think the four of us kind of agree on this kind of macro level, but the way we do it and the way we, our individual styles might be different, and that's okay. That's okay. And we wanted to offer yes. those varying opinions and styles to lots of folks. But this is a kooky bunch, and I'm so grateful to be a part of it because it is part of the fun for me. You know, it's like a twofold. I get to be out there giving good information and having important discussions, and I got to hang out with buddies and do it and have some fun.
That's the other thing. This topic, we're dealing with, you know, difficult conversations. We're talking about sex addiction and betrayal, or, you know, sexuality, or, you know, other things around relationships, which can go well, but sometimes they can go really, really poorly and really painful. So healing after betrayal is really heavy. It's really difficult. It's really traumatizing. So we also need to, you know, build some life back in too, I think. And that's part of why I think we have this synergy in the life that we bring together, because there's so much heaviness already in this topic. So I'm grateful for you guys, for you all. It's been amazing being part of this.
That's great. And one question I had, and y'all spoken to this a little bit, is, you know, I'm curious, as y'all have begun doing this regularly, I mean, these relationships were pre-existing, you know, before the podcast, but now you've been intentional. You've been intentionally doing this for some time now. How have you seen this grow you professionally, maybe even personally, what you do in your practice? Like, how's it showing up when you're not sitting around together recording your conversations?
I'll speak to that. I it's been interesting just hearing what you all, how you all conceptualize things, and maybe different than the way I've been thinking about it. So even as we're having a conversation, even if we think we're on the same page, we might not be, but I learn something from you all each time, even as we're going through it, like, oh, I haven't thought about it that way. Or actually maybe I disagree, and this is kind of how I've seen it. So it's made me really rethink through things that I've been doing for a while and hone things even more, or expand what I thought I knew, and maybe, you know, build on that. So that's been really helpful. And how can I, you know, analogies you all bring that I hadn't thought of that really helped to kind of crystallize this in a better way. I can bring that to my clients in my practice, or just how I'm approaching this work that we do. It's been helpful for me.
So we also have guests on the podcast. And so whenever we have a guest on that's specializing in gaslighting, betrayal, trauma, empathy, a whole host of different topics, we try to bring people on that are specialists and, you know, really good at what they do. And so I always learn from those guests coming on, even if I've read their book or listened to their podcast. It's amazing to have them real life. And Jake, we had you on the podcast, and that was just a really wonderful experience. And I'll have to admit, I was like, Jake Porter, oh, Absat's right. I should probably listen to more of his podcast before he comes on the show. And so it's always a push for me to learn more.
That's so good. So good. And Jeannie, it looked like you had something to add too.
Yeah, I did. Thanks. Back to, well, both Dan and Wendy, it does help me to, because I know my thoughts, right? And I'm in my office and in my world. And Tim and I are business partners. And so we're talking every day. So I kind of have a general understanding of where he stands. Although sometimes I'm completely surprised and we have these really interesting conversations live. But to also hear Wendy and Dan, who I don't talk with on a daily basis, and hear their expansion, the way they describe things or their opinions on things, it helps broaden my horizons and my understandings, which in my world just feeds into the work I do with my clients. So whatever I can do as a professional to stay current, to stay inquisitive and curious, I think that benefits our clients. And the listeners get to listen to that whole discussion. So it's benefiting me professionally, personally, and at the same time, providing that information for the viewers.
Wow. Wow, that's great. Well, why don't we allow our listeners to experience some of this conversation? Yeah, I'm sure. They've been fully warned at this point. They ought to have a good idea of what's coming. No, I think this is awesome because, and I will make myself say this one statement without completely mounting a soapbox here, but the ability to have a conversation, even a hard conversation, and maintain respect in the midst of maybe some disagreement is something we so desperately need more of in our society. And I'll just leave that right there. So what we thought we would do is bring up some hard questions and let you guys have the conversations that you have around these hard questions and hear different opinions and where there's overlap and where there's conflict and work through those. And I know I have total confidence that as we do that, there's going to be some really good, insightful bits of truth and wisdom in there for our listeners. So here's some questions that I know every one of us professionals have heard these from clients. And we'll start with this one, from a female betrayed partner. Does my husband really love me? Or did my husband really love me? You know, as they look back at the acting out, at the addictive behaviors, how could he possibly love me and do that? And I'm going to just toss this to Dan to start with.
Thanks, Jake.
You bet, buddy.
I want to say to Jake, hey, you're part of the conversation. So just, you know, if you're part of the conversation too, you know, come on in here. We'd love to hear your thoughts and opinions on these hard topics too. Sorry to interrupt, Dan.
Yeah, only those we'd like to hear Dan's. We'd like to hear Dan's.
Yes.
I think, how do I say it? I would say yes and no on some level. Yes and a qualified with an asterisk. Most of the men I've worked with don't want to lose their relationship. They do care for their partner. They're terrified if the partner wants to separate. Typically, they don't want that. Is that love? They care deeply, but in active addiction, it's inherently narcissistic because the person is making decisions to preserve their relationship with their addiction. They're acting, you know, in self-preservation, they're hiding, they're deceiving, they're gaslighting. So they're doing these emotionally abusive behaviors, which is not loving. And I think addicts, until they really get in recovery, may have a real confusion around what love is. They trade intensity. They think an intimacy is intensity. So love is all this dopamine type behaviors when it's obviously much deeper than that. So no, they didn't really love you on some level because of their actions, but I do think that the core, it's not neither or. I don't think that the addict does want to leave the relationship. They do care deeply for the partner. So I don't know if that makes any sense. I think you can, and if it's kind of like a both and, it's a qualified yes and a no. How would you guys look at it?
I think that's a great place to start. Wendy, I see you taking copious notes. So why don't you jump in?
Well, yeah. So one of the pieces that caught my ear was when Dan said decisions. They're making decisions, and I don't agree with that. I don't think that they are cognizant of what they're doing in the addiction. I really believe that addicts become dissociated and that they are not in their right minds, and so they are not thinking through the consequences. They are not thinking through. It's a highly activated state. So when I want to say I believe this because when discovery happens and when disclosure happens, they're shocked at most addicts are shocked at the behaviors that they have been doing. And so and I hear over and over again that I did not mean to hurt my partner. This I just was kind of off doing my thing. And so I had no idea of the impact that this would have. So along those lines, I hear consistently, of course I love my wife. Of course I want to be married. Of course, you know, I want this relationship. I do love her. And I agree with Dan that as addicts get into recovery, they start to say, you know, I don't know if I know what love is, actually, if I'm being honest. So I thought I did, but I know I'm deeply attached to my partner as much as I can be, but I need to learn how to do relationship better, how to know myself better and my partner better.
Mm. Jeannie, pick up that baton, run with it.
Thank you, sir. So there's two parts, right? There's, in my mind, there's the addict who, with Wendy talking about this level of dissociation and not being conscious of choice and such and not thinking through consequences. And I feel the need to say, and still responsible for their behavior and decisions. And I know that Wendy wasn't implying that they weren't responsible. I just want to bring that voice of betrayed partner into, okay, I get he may not have been thinking of me, and I'm still impacted by what he did, and there's still accountability to be had. When I think of the question, Jake, I feel like I hear the underneath question, how, if he loved me, how could he do this? Not so much, does he love me? Mm-hmm. If he loved me, I thought he loved me, he said he loved me, well then how can this happen? And then we're in a discussion about addiction. So I feel like sometimes there's this question and then there's the question underneath.
Thank you all. Now, Tim, you can give us the right answer.
You don't need to give him in that platform. You don't need to give him that platform.
You just left the building. Oh, that's an example of good times.
Tim's head's gonna float away.
it's bigger.
Oh boy.
What comes to mind for me is I hear all of these. You know, first of all, I think it's important to recognize that not everybody who gets into a relationship loves the other person. And I think that's true with addicts as well as true with non-addicts. You know, people get into relations for a variety of reasons. Some people are highly manipulative. Some people are narcissistic to the point of it being excessively manipulative and painful and abusive to the other person. And would we say that that person loves their partner? I think that sometimes that question is no. So I just want to acknowledge that I think that there are those, I don't think that's the norm, but I think that there are those possibilities out there. I agree that the basic two areas that we're talking about are one, the neurology, and that split mindset that addicts have, and then the emotional experience. From a neurology perspective, you know, addicts really resonate with, and it really makes sense for addicts when they're in recovery to have this experience of who I am when I'm not wrapped up in my addiction, when my addict brain is not active, and who am I when my addict brain is going on and my addict is active. And an addict that's not in their addict brain can be very loving, can be very kind, can feel very, very meaningfully connected to their partner. And all of that stuff fits in with sort of what we think of as a loving, caring, mutually respective relationship. And then when their addict brain kicks in and their neurology is driving them to that escape, that it can look radically different. And that can look manipulative. It can, you know, not thoughtful and not at all loving in any way. And so there's that neurological split, which can be very confusing for partners, because it's like, well, does he love me or does he not love me? And the answer in some ways is both. It sort of depends on neurologically where they're at right now. Mm. I think the other piece is that emotional piece. Addicts have been using their addiction to manage the discomfort in their lives for a long time. So from an emotional perspective, addicts are in the shallow end of their emotional experiences. So how deeply do they feel any emotion, which includes love? Probably not super deeply. And it's very common for addicts to sort of like increase their depth of emotional awareness. I recognize that emotional growth in my own recovery experience. And I was working as a therapist when I got into recovery. And still there was this significant emotional growth that took place. In 12-step programs, you know, we often talk about making that 2-foot drop out of living primarily from your cognitive head and moving into more of a body emotion-based experience of life. And so I think that the other piece is that what addicts experience as love is going to deepen and become more broad and more meaningful as they move into recovery. And so I think the partner is going to experience that shift as well. So there's the right answer.
Okay. Well, thank you for the right answer, Tim. That was great. Now, you know, if as I listen to all of you, I think I agree with pretty much everything everybody said. Some language that I often use about this question is to try to get it out of a frame in which it's a yes or no question. Does he love me or not? Did he love me or not? Yes or no? And to think about how love could be on a spectrum, or there could be a capacity to love. And what if someone is loving as much as they have the capacity to within an active addiction? You know, and that it comes with an acknowledgement that there's a lack of capacity that needs to be developed, but without, you know, saying that there wasn't anything genuine or real at all. Jeannie?
Thanks. There's someone case coming to mind, but sometimes when this comes up, I see it as when the addict is doing that exploration of what is love, because the partner will sometimes say, how does he love me? How could he love me? How could she love me? But when the addict sometimes takes on this experience of curiosity about love in general, and they get very philosophical. Have I ever loved? Did I ever feel loved? What is love? Two things. One, that can be a really positive thing, because it shows that the addict is really looking deeply into their history, into their belief systems, trying to really understand themselves. However, for a partner, when they hear the addict doing this exploration, the partner will then come sometimes fear, wait a second, I thought he loved me, but now he's saying he, she. The addict is saying, I don't know if I've ever loved or had or know how to love. But I do see when an addict does this exploration that right. It is a positive sign of recovery, because they're expanding, they're looking outside of themselves and trying to figure it out.
I think that's
well said. Let me just end real quick and say that this is part of this dynamic that I really love about the conversations, is that you're getting different perspectives on this one answer or this one question. And even though I joke around like I have the right answer, none of the answers here are wrong. And everybody's got a slightly different perspective on it. And I love that about these conversations, is that we're pushing, we're jostling, we're exploring, we're talking. And I think the people who are listening to the podcast, I think they get to hear that wide spectrum of professional perspectives that all have validity, even though they don't maybe match up exactly with each other.
Yes. Yeah. I would agree. That's really well said. Thank you, Tim. Let's go to another question, another hard question. So again, from the perspective of a betrayed partner, am I an idiot for staying? Wendy, why don't you take that one first?
Thanks, Jake.
You're so welcome.
So when the partner discovers the infidelity, the betrayal, there's a lot of thoughts and feelings that are going on. And so for a lot of partners, when they enter into the relationship, they might say, oh, I have a hard line. He ever cheats, he ever watches porn. If he watches porn, I don't know about it, you know, whatever the boundary is for them, I'm out. And then it happens. And then they can feel very confused and torn, because it's different in real time when these things happen. So I believe that the partner definitely goes through the stages of grief. And one of the stages of grief is bargaining. And so I think this question, I've never had a partner where they don't say, well, maybe I'll stay or maybe I'll leave. There's very few that are just automatically out. So am I stupid for staying? No. The big answer is no. This is a complicated dynamic. And what I say is, well, let's see what the addict does. Does he or she enter into recovery? Do they start going to meetings? Do they start the really hard work of self-examination? Do they stop the behaviors? Are they doing everything they can to try to make to be different, to start to act differently? Are they doing the research around what this is and understanding their own brains? So that's the long and the short answer.
Thank you. Jeannie? Oh, go ahead, Jeannie, and then Dan.
Okay. I'm thinking about components of a strong relationship. And one of those components is trust. And so I try to encourage betrayed partners to not pathologize their healthy, trusting behavior. Right? It was a good thing that they wanted to and trusted their partner. That is not a bad thing. We want to encourage trust, which is why the betrayal of trust is such a destructive force in the coupleship. So when the betrayed partner, was I an idiot to stay, or how can I not have seen these things? How come I didn't know, ask more questions? Because you were lovingly giving trust to your relationship partner. Now, we've learned more, and now we understand more. We might notice more, do more differently in the future. But to pathologize a healthy relationship component, I'm trying to encourage folks to have some grace and to not go down that path. Because no, they're not an idiot. No, they're not stupid. No, they're not whatever word they want to put in there for having a good, or trying to work on good relationship skills. I don't know if Dan.
Well, that was literally going to be my answer. Thank you, Jeannie. So on to Dan.
Jake and I are besties.
There you go. I just wanted to emphasize, Esther Perel talked about, you know, staying after infidelity as the new scarlet letter in society. So, you know, Nathaniel Hawthorne's book, The Scarlet Letter, which was where someone who was an adulterer. So on the other side, you know, back then it was, if you had an affair, if you engaged in adultery, you were the one chastised by society. I think now it's the opposite. So we get the scarlet letter is staying after infidelity. And unfortunately, we see this, you know, with these public cases, you see it personally. You know, I'm sure anyone listening to this, many people have experienced this firsthand, where you share with somebody, or you've heard this, some version of, well, if I were with this, you know, person, fill in the blank, I would never stay. I would never do that. You know, you'll hear versions of that. And I just want to emphasize that I think there's this pathologizing of the betrayed partner, as opposed to looking at where we need to be focusing our energy, is saying that the betrayed partner is not the problem here. It's the betrayer. So, you know, I just think I want to emphasize that part, that we hear these messages. So that's, I think, where it can get ingrained. And it's more normal to stay because there's history. There's shared, you know, it could be decades of history. There's family, there's entwined lives. And it's not like you can just cut that off. That's a death. I mean, we kind of fuse together over time, even though we have separateness. We know electromagnetically, like we combine, we're connected. And so why do people that have been married for so long, when one person dies, the other person may die within a year? We're so connected. So that doesn't just sever immediately and we can just walk away from that. There's so much connection. And I think that, and it's confusing, and it takes time, and it takes a grief process to even see where we come through. So I try to take a real compassionate approach, and none of us know what we'll do until we actually are there. So the people that say, if I were, is a hypothetical, but when we're actually in that situation, it seems more common, at least in our population, that more people stay and try to figure it out than the opposite. So I just want to emphasize that part.
Thank you, Dan.
I think that there's also another piece when we're asking that question, am I an idiot if I stay? I don't like that wording because it feels rather harsh, but I think it's important to also at the same time accept what's the reality. I mean, am I staying because I'm expecting there to be a radical, complete change in my partner? Now, addicts are going to change in the recovery process, and the change can be profound. But at the same time, sort of like, there are going to be core pieces of who they are, their personality, their sense of humor, different things. You know, if somebody struggles with social skills or social kind of, you know, Asperger-y kind of stuff, that's not going to change because of recovery. You know, if somebody's sense of humor might clean up and not be as sexual as it was before, but their sense of humor is probably going to stay very similar. And so there's this piece of, are you staying because you're expecting the addict to be a completely different person? And if that's what you're staying for, then I think you're going to be disappointed and frustrated. And you know, if you don't like who your partner is, recovery may not change that. Now, recovery can bring a whole lot of different stuff on how they approach things, and rigorous honesty and being transparent and being open and being more emotionally present. But I think it's really important when you're not right out the gate of discovery and right out of the gate of working on recovery, but down the road, I think there's a really important piece of accepting what's the reality of who I am in my healing process, what's the reality of who the addict is and my partner in the recovery process, and what's the reality of our relationship? And let's acknowledge the reality, and is that what we want?
Yeah. Jeannie, I saw that hand.
So here's an example. Jake, you're in charge. You're the host. You tell us if we're starting to go off the rails, because this is sometimes what happens in our podcast, is somebody says something and then the whole conversation kind of shoop, and goes to the left a little bit. So when Tim's talking about when Tim's talking about that change, and you know, what's part of the personality and what's part of recovery, on the betrayed partner side, isn't that such an important question that we're always having, and I'm guessing you guys are having in your caseloads too, is this addiction I'm seeing? Or is this the impact of addiction, or is this who they are? And especially as someone is going through and has good sobriety and they're working on recovery and they're trying these new skills, but everyone's imperfect, of course. But on the betrayed partner, what are appropriate expectations the betrayed partners are asking themselves. Because is this who that person is? Are they still in evolution? Have they started evolution? Like trying to gauge whether I want to be in relationship with this version of this person. Are they done changing? So this sort of unknowing of appropriate expectations, or where does this end, or what does it look like when it lands the plane in addiction recovery? That's really hard from a betrayed partner kind of side too. They're always watching.
Well,
and trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
Wendy?
Right. So, So dovetailing on what Jeannie's saying, I have so many partners that will say, I think there's something really wrong with them. I mean, I think there's sex addiction, but I think there's something else. Can we do, a full psychological, profile to find out, and rightfully so, partners are trying to understand what this is, can they live with it? And so, so I'll have partners that will, ask for psych evals or, to go and have a psychiatric evaluation. I'm curious, with the team, what do you think about that? Is that like a helpful thing? Have you seen that to be a helpful thing or not?
The one area where I found that to be helpful is when neurodiversity seems to be in the mix, and being able to identify, hey, there's a neurodiversity issue here going on. That's likely not going to change a lot. And sometimes, partners, are experiencing them as difficult, and they think that this must be an addiction thing. And if they just get sober, the neurodiversity piece is going to go away. Mm-hmm. And it's no, that there's always going to be that neurodiversity flavor to them, regardless of whether they're sober and regardless of how far they step into recovery. That one particular issue is where I found the psychological evaluations to be exceptionally helpful.
Yeah. And I will add, I would back that up. And I would say the other diagnosis that I've seen come out of those evaluations that has been really helpful is obsessive compulsive personality disorder. Different than OCD, different than just obsessive compulsive disorder, right? The actual personality disorder, which is simultaneously the most prevalent of the personality disorders and the most underdiagnosed of the personality disorders. So there are a lot of people out there who have obsessive compulsive personality disorder that are going to struggle with empathy, and they're going to struggle, or I should say it like this, they're going to struggle with how we normally think empathy looks and feels, right? It's not going to be the same. And recovery, addiction recovery is not going to change it. Now, there are some skills-based, methods for counseling that can help with that, but addiction recovery is not going to fundamentally change that personality. So I like psych evals. I think more data is often really helpful. Really helpful.
Well, can I just say that too? I mean, talking about personality disorders, someone in active addiction is going to act narcissistically. That is different than narcissistic personality disorder, right? So knowing if someone is diagnosed with a Axis two personality disorder, if someone actually has narcissistic personality disorder, their ability to fundamentally change is going to be a lot more limited than someone who has narcissistic tendencies that they get into active recovery and they learn the skills and then they can, they can change and they can grow. I think the capacity of someone who doesn't have the personality disorder to grow and change is a lot greater than someone who has the personality disorder, because those don't change fundamentally over time. Those character kind of personality disorders. So I do think it can be helpful. Does everyone have narcissistic personality disorder that as an addict? No, I don't think so. Some people might disagree, but I don't think that's the case.
Yeah. And in the same way that we would not take a betrayed partner and immediately diagnose this betrayed partner with borderline personality disorder, that would be a terrible thing to do. I feel the same way about narcissism with addicts. Let's see what recovery does. Let's see if these narcissistic traits come down a bit, right? And one more thing I always like to say when we get into the subject of psych evals is they're not perfect. So even if you go and have one, or you ask your partner to take one and they do, and, you know, and you get news back, oh, this says high narcissistic traits. They can be wrong. The assessments can be wrong. And so we have to take the data, but hold it in an open hand as more is revealed. So, yeah, that could be its own, a whole other topic. Very good. So, okay, let's take on the next question. How will I know when I need to leave? How will I know when I need to leave? Tim, you've been wrapping it up every time. Why don't you start this one?
How will I know when I need to leave? Okay.
That was an evil laugh, Wendy.
I know. Yes.
Oh, yeah, you're enjoying this one. How will a partner, and I'm assuming that we're talking about this from a partner perspective, how will a partner know that they need to leave? I think when a partner is recognizing that over an extended period of time, that the pain and the patterns and their life, their life essence is just being drained away from them. And when it's just too painful, you know, and it might be that the addict has done great work in their recovery and there's just been too much pain and too much damage. And it might be that the addict is really struggling in their recovery and the partner just, they realize they need more. I don't think that that's a decision to make in the first year. I think it's something to look at 2 to 3 years on and that larger period of time and what's going on. But if you're miserable and you've been miserable and there isn't perceptible change in what's going on with your experience, then I think that if it works for you, in your value system, in your relationship system, in your sense of what you need to do for your own self-care, then I think it's important to acknowledge that reality.
Thank you. Yeah. Jeannie?
Did you see me motioning? Having mind thoughts?
I did. I saw you taking notes.
Oh, I should be careful while you can take notes. No, I'm in. The way I'm, everyone's different. So let me just say that first, right? This is an individual decision. There are, I don't want to say rights and wrongs. These situations are painful and complex. And so there's not an easy answer to this question, which is why it's one of those hard questions. I would encourage betrayed partners, I'm thinking of in my mind, to, if they want to make that kind of a decision, I always tell my clients, I support you no matter what. Can we make that decision when you have a more cognitive, regulated brain? So in the first stages, often folks are very traumatized, which leads to, you know, difficulty with thinking and sleeping and eating. That's not always the best time to make your life choices. So I respect my client's choice to their own decisions about their life. This is their life. But I try to educate about the impact of the trauma experience on life decisions. So if you make this decision, let it be when you're in a calmer brain so that you can do all that you need to do, say that you need to say, ask the questions you need to ask, so that if you do make this decision to end this marriage or relationship, later you have less regrets regarding your efforts and your needs. You feel like you've done all that you could. You'll have less regrets or concerns afterwards. So for me, it's about empowerment, calm brain, looking at your options and your choices, and how will you know? People tend to lean to one side or the other at a period, kind of some markers in time. But focusing on that,
yes,
you know what, maybe not when I'm doing a trauma brain make this decision, And if you want to make that decision in 2 weeks, 1 month, 6 months, a year, whatever, I'm gone. But let's make it from a calm brain. That's where I start the conversation.
Mm. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Jeannie. Wendy?
Yeah. So I lean on the neurobiological. Tim mentions it quite a bit, and I agree that that's a really wonderful perspective because our brains are complicated. And so making a decision when someone's in fight or flight, that's not the best place to make a decision from. And what I wish for partners is that they know when they're in trauma and they can recognize what happens for them when they're in that brain, and also when they know when they're in shock. It's hard sometimes to determine a shock state from a calm state because they can feel very similar. So that distinction, I think, is really critical to the partner to know themselves. And I think that when they've gone through the grieving of the realization of what has happened is happening, the last stage of grief is acceptance. And so there's a certain body sensation when anyone is in that place of acceptance. And so I think it's this piece of seeing things very, very clearly and being able to say what exactly is happening with the addict, what is happening internally for themselves. And then it's, you know what, I am married to a sex addict, this is my life, and I'm in. Or I'm married to a sex addict and I'm seeing things that are not tenable, that are not sustainable for me, and I'm done. But it comes from that very solid, grounded place.
Yeah, thank you. Dan?
Yeah, I've got a lot of thoughts swirling, so I'm not sure how it'll come out. But I was just thinking of the 12 steps. So someone who's in active recovery, when I think of, you know, if you think of the 12 steps, 10, 11, 12 are what they call the maintenance steps. And that's the ongoing work that someone does for the rest of their life. But if I'm the 10th, 11th is basically I'm looking at myself and seeing what could I have done better in a given day? And I own my stuff, and I try to work on that. And then I'm really, really working on myself, building my relationship with my higher power or with God. And then, you know, I'm also trying to serve and help others. I think that the actual relational piece then is, am I working to love my partner better, to help heal and restore the damage done, and help and build a relationship, not just the damage done, but then also can we build something back bigger and better than it was before? And I think, so I guess for me, when I see, and this may be overly simplistic, but when I see relationships, and this is kind of transcends recovery stuff, but when I see relationships that are doing better than the ones that don't, it's you have someone two people that are really willing to work on themselves, to heal, you know, and kind of be better versions of themselves each day. And then also to take a step and say, how can I love my partner better? May sound overly simplistic, but when I see people doing that work over time, those relationships seem to do better because they're constantly looking at themselves, healing and growing. And they're also trying to see, how can I love better? I've had plenty of clients that are really willing to do that. And I've had some that don't. And if the addict, particularly the addict in this case, I think there's more onus on them, but the partner over time to start doing some of that too. I think if you're not seeing someone who's really, really working on themselves and trying to heal and you know, be a better version of themselves, and then also really working to love the spouse, the partner better, long term, the relationship starts to fizzle and it doesn't work. It starts getting starved, or you know, you have emotional abuse stuff that keeps going. It just doesn't work long term. So those are the things when I've seen relationships not work out. It's usually because either the person really couldn't commit to recovery for themselves, or they just really were still kind of stuck in themselves and they really weren't trying to heal and restore the relationship, and that their partners, you know, the impact of betrayal. So that's what I've seen, and I don't want to overly simplify it, but I've definitely, you know, that daily work I think is so critical, and partners see it. they'll see it. It's the wait and see. And you unfortunately, some people really try to do it, and some people, you know, some addicts don't.
Mm, thank you, Dan. Really well said. Well, this has been a lot of fun. I think we need to start wrapping this up. But, you know, it took us 6 months to get this thing scheduled and actually executed. Maybe in 6 months we could do it again, because there are more hard conversations that we could have. It's really been great. Thank y'all. Thank you all. Y'all could hear my Southern drawl coming out there. Thank y'all for coming. That was a lot of fun. Really appreciate all of you. Oh, listen to the crowd going wild there, clapping, applauding.
Thank you, Jake.
That's great. Yes, thank you. And listeners, we'll have all the links to get to this podcast and all of these fine folks down in the show notes below. And we look forward to seeing you all again soon.
Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of Betrayal Recovery Radio, hosted by Dr. Jake Porter. If you value the content we've shared today, please feel free to rate, subscribe, and leave a review. This helps others find the show, and we greatly appreciate it. For more resources, visit APSATS.org. That's APSATS.org.